Hey, everybody, on this edition of I Talk Movies, we're going to get up close and personal with the talent behind the film Love Is All You Need. Let's do it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And then, here's Popcorn Talk's I Talk Movies.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Popcorn Talk and I Talk Movies right here, where we get a chance to get up close and personal with the creators and talent involved in bringing some of your favorite films to the screen. I'm your host, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter at HappyGoJackie. Now, the people that I have assembled here on the panel here are behind the film Love Is All You Need. It originally started off as a short film. It has now had its feature-length debut. It's been touring the film festival circuits and just recently available on iTunes as of November, so you can actually download it and enjoy it in your very own home. I've got with us here a co-creator and director, K. Rocco Shields, one of the executive producers and actresses, Catherine Lanasa, and co-writer, David Tillman. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
There you go. So, Love Is All You Need. It originally started off as a short film. So, for that, what made you decide, like, all right, maybe a short is better to approach this concept first and then see if there's enough traction? Did you originally have a feature length in mind from the very beginning?
I guess I'll take this one.
Yes, you take that one.
So, you know, this film was created in response to the plight of those that have been discriminated against. And it was my vision to take this concept and create something that could speak to the masses about something that people don't normally think about in a new way and hopes to change it. I knew it was a different concept that's been done, so we started it as a short film, always intending to make it a feature film. And when the short film leaked on the internet and went to 50 million people, we knew we had something.
Now, what I like about it is, and I had a chance to talk to Blake from the film as well, too. What I thought when we were speaking is that you saw many other kind of, I want to say, like gender flops or identity switch kind of films, but seeing like a sexuality swap, so to speak, had never really been approached in a film. And you think about it, it's like, wow, that is like an idea that's like so obvious, like staring everybody in the face. It's like, why did it take this long for somebody to say, like, you know what, this is a great story way to present this sort of issue? Where when you were coming up with this, were you surprised, like, like nobody's ever done this before? Why am I the first one doing this?
We're actually not the first to do it. It's actually been done before. It's okay. Been done in a play called Xana Don't, and it's been done in other movies, actually. But the thing that has been done before is that they use stereotypes and stigma to define the world, so it never was able to cross over because it wasn't universally relatable. So with our film, my main rule is that the world looks exactly like our own. When, you know, you think of a gay world, you think rainbows in the sky and everyone's skipping around singing show tunes. That's not the case, because that's not what gay looks like to me. It looks like normal people. And so that's ultimately what's there. But the one liberty we did take is we felt that men and women would be on equal playing fields. So in traditional man roles, you'll see females there. But There's equality. And I think that's what's important.
Now, was there a lot of world building that goes on just in terms of putting the story together, though it may not translate to the audience? Because I know you set up the situation about like the birthing process and things like that. Those kind of world building elements, was there a lot of just like, well, how would this world function if it is like same sex relationships and heterosexuality is the abnormality as opposed to the norm?
Absolutely. Like Rocco and I worked extensively on, you know, how would this world have come to this decision? So we actually had two different parallel story points. One that started in Greek mythology with the story of the Trojan War, that after the Trojan War, the change came. And then we decided to go down the path of after the Great Flood with Noah. And Noah received a revelation that because of the way men had treated women and the crimes and things that were happening, that this is the way that would be, so that there would be equality, that they would live in same-sex couples and, you know, come together in September for the breeding season so the babies were born in springtime. So we actually did create two worlds and chose, okay, this is the one that would speak mostly to our community, to our world, you know, the U.S. population for the most part. But we went into a lot of details of why things are so that when questions were asked, you know, we would have answers for them. But also when you're creating something and you're going to set up a set of rules for you, like Rocco said about the equality, that was a big part of the world building, and therefore, how is that going to be seen then in the film?
So how much deliberation went to, like, how far back in history do we make some sort of divergent path in when you're kind of setting everything up for how this world relates?
Well, actually, it's interesting, because we had to have it down and for us as, like, you know, writers, we wanted to make sure we knew where the world originated so we could speak truth to it. But in the film, it is not discussed mm-hmm. because the film is not about the definition of this reversal. It is about showcasing prejudice from a different lens. So we made that decision. There's a couple little elements in there where we explain a little, but ultimately we're making some videos that will appear only digitally that will explain it a lot more. We just didn't feel like the film needed that explanation.
But what I thought was cool is just how much what the audience will never see is just how much work you had to do to kind of figure out the rules of this world that you're telling the story in.
Yes.
Just the challenges of that, just how much time and effort goes into that, and the audience will never actually see all that hard work that you put in, but it makes telling the story so much easier for you because you now understand sort of like the playing field that you have to tell the story in.
Absolutely.
So I was just going to say, I love the device of flipping the world. I think, you know, just from, you know, I'm a straight person, but, and I've never had for some reason, I don't know, maybe I was a professional ballet dancer. My brother was obviously gay to me since I was like a little kid and he was a littler kid. So it's never been, I've never had like a sense of separation from anybody because of their sexuality. It's not really, I just don't really think about it. It's like, oh, they have brown hair or something. But I think that the device is so great for people that do struggle with it, or people that have kids that struggle with it, or family members that struggle with homosexuality, because it really does put them in the shoes. And they're just, the story that they're watching, the people that are being outcast or bullied are being bullied because they're heterosexual, because of the flip. So, you know, you're not asking your bigoted uncle to watch two gay people making out and have feelings for them. You know, it's like, that's just like way too much overload. But I think that by making the kids or the young adults that are getting bullied in the movie because of their sexuality straight and that flip, it really does allow people to just come in this way that's just sort of seamless, because you're just tracking these love stories and then it really puts a shoe on the other foot. Very powerful, I think. I love that inversion. I think it really helps it make it a wonderful teaching tool. And I've seen Rocco have like, one girl came up to her and said that her mother had seen it at our first film festival and had called her after not talking to her for 20 years because she now kind of got it and understood. And I think I sent it home with someone that works for me, and you know, they're pretty strict Catholics, and I was a little bit worried about how they would feel about it, but you know, they were able to show it to their grandchild and like not show him the parts that were a little inappropriate for him for his age. And then he ended up opening up about how he'd been bullied in school and what was going on with him, and they didn't even know kind of what was going on with him. So it really sets kids talking, I think, when they see it as well. It sort of creates an environment for dialogue.
Well, certainly as I was watching the film and you see Jude and Ryan just come together, you're wondering, why it's so obvious? So why is everybody against him? And I can understand, like, that makes it such an easy message to deliver to the masses. Like, yes, you can easily fall, because it's just, for us, was the societal norm in our world. So you're wondering, why are people so against this? So it makes it very easy to kind of deliver that message.
Exactly. It's the first film of its kind because it's designed to cross over into, like she said, an audience that would not normally go see an LGBTQ film. This is a film for our community, for them.
Speaking of that, I'll roll the trailer here real quick just to give the audiences an idea of the film that we're talking about here.
I know this is wrong, but
I guess they don't understand love like ours. Maybe they never will.
Well, isn't our love the same as theirs?
It is.
God blesses you on this day and forgives those that ask his forgiveness.
Sinner! 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 Sinner!
I've been having impure thoughts. I can't make the thoughts go away. I don't know if I want to.
You're living in a very rapidly changing time, a time that promotes things like equality.
What are you, Emily? Some kind of row?
What, no. What's a row?
Heterosexual.
Well, what's a heterosexual?
Something you're too young to know about.
Row, 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 row!
Did you know that your friend Ryan was kicked out of his fraternity?
Oh, the cushion for the cushion.
They think he's a closet hetero. Isn't that funny?
It's really surprising.
You know, some years ago, they hid behind closed doors, as they should have.
as they should still, but now may live very openly. They live brazenly. They live without remorse.
Now, one character that I thought in there, Elizabeth Rahm, as Reverend Rachel, I found her such an interesting character because, man, it just, you know, certainly as the backstory's kind of revealed that, as they say, like, her sister may have come out as a heterosexual. So maybe kind of clouding her judgment and sort of things. But just, like, how much of the advice, or when she's in service and she's talking to Jude, like, how much of it is just motivated by just her personal feelings as opposed to trying to be open and objective and is just a messenger of the Lord, like trying to be open and help this person through a journey, as opposed to, nope, I don't like it, so you shouldn't like it, and that's what you should do. How did you handle the Reverend Richard character? How did you want her to operate in the story?
Important to this film is to root everything in reality. So actually, everything that happens in the movie has actually happened in real life. We wanted to keep that integrity so we could speak, you know, to a larger cause, that this stuff is happening, it does happen, and obviously it's more front and center than ever. The Reverend Rachel is verbatim taken from Fred Phelps of the Westboro Baptist Church. So man, those are actual sermons that and things that he has said.
Wow, because just in the way that you show the scenes where she's busy doing photo shoots with the husband and their child, just like, boy, where exactly is her head at in this whole sort of thing? Is she more motivated about getting the word out, or, you know, just capitalizing on something as opposed to actually being there for people that are going through this, just these life choices that they're trying to make?
Westboro uses the media to send their message very loud and clear, and ultimately what they feel is that they were put on this earth to speak to the masses about how homosexuality is basically destroying our world. They believe that God sent the flood back in the days of Noah because he was angry about about the things that were going on, one of which was sodomy, as it's stated. And so they believe that that great flood is going to come again. And so that's why you see them out there with their signs, God hates, is because of that. And so we wanted to bring that front and center and use the very same reasoning and the same logic that they use in the film.
I will say, as I was reading about why teachers that would show this in school and have difficulties with the public in their school systems, some of the words were like, it's part of the militant sodomite agenda, which
yep.
I had never even heard that was such a thing.
I kind of love that. I want to start a little army, you know, we get a little costume, do a little goose step. The militant sodomites.
They called me the face of the sodomite agenda.
Yeah.
I did not even know such a term existed. Like, wow,
you know,
what
we should
this?
Go. We should go. It's that for Halloween next year. The militant sodomite agenda.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. I'm also a fag pimp. They've called Westboro tweeted to me on Twitter.
Fag yes. pimp.
And she's the harbinger of Christ's return.
I'm bringing
right
back.
Here in your studio.
Wow, look
harbinger
at that. I did not realize we had such a celebrity here. That's fantastic.
Right here.
Thank you. Yes, yay. Look at that. Yes. Rocco.
I might have to steal that. That just might be my new handle. Hashtag
yeah.
fag pimp.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fag pimp.
Bring it.
I played a pimp on TV, a pimp of men, but they were straight. I hadn't even thought about being a fag pimp.
Yeah.
It's catchy.
I was a pimp in satisfaction. Yeah.
So when you do the short, did you already have the feature film in mind about what you wanted to do? And then basically, was it just a process of what do we strip out to do the short and then add back in when we do the feature?
No.
Actually, we did come up with the short film idea first, and with the idea that we were going to make a feature because Rocco wanted to test the waters with the concept. But the feature film version, we actually had like 70 different versions. And almost every storyline that you see in the film that you saw was basically its own movie. And then we just took, one night she called me, she goes, okay, don't kill me, but I have this idea. And then she explained to me how we were going to take these 7 or 8 different storylines, like Crash, and we were going to interweave them. They were going to be in and out of time sequence. And you shared my screen, right?
I had a graph.
Yeah, so she was showing me on my computer screen, moving things around, and then this, then it's going to, okay. Let's do it. You know?
That's why I love you.
Thank you. Always just saying yes. Yes and. Yes. Yes and.
Well, what's a shame was that, you know, to show everybody's storyline that was actually shot and some of the ones that we couldn't shoot would have been like a 3-hour movie, but every single storyline you see had a full beginning, middle, and end. Even down to the guys who were getting their picture taken with their kid
really?
Had an integral part at the end of the movie. So it's like, just like Crash, everything is interconnected.
Yeah. That's now coming up with the various storylines. Was there one that you, as you're kind of plotting out what you wanted to showcase, that you figured like this would be the one film that we, one storyline that we should use as a short, and then once we get it to the feature, we'll kind of start adding in these others.
Always for the feature, I wanted to take it further and show an adult love story where we see two people, Romeo and Juliet, fall in love and are torn apart for this reason of prejudice and hate that happens every day to the LGBTQ community. And when we were writing it, we first set it in high school, and we realized with the power of the short film and how that, you know, really brought it home for a lot of audiences, we could not ignore the plight of a young girl committing suicide. We could not ignore the bullying that goes on in commenting on this larger story. And as we started writing it, things started happening actually in real life that reflected the movie, even to the teachers, you know, getting fired. Teachers were got fired for showing the short film in their school, not just once but twice. And we had to go, and like I had to go save their jobs. Both
she
times.
Literally went to Palatka, Florida to save this guy's job. Went to the school board. The school board was going to have a big meeting, and then they were going to do it a secret meeting. And then when they found out she was coming, they didn't have their meeting. You know, they were trying to do things, everything behind closed doors. So it was pretty amazing.
So we put that story in.
Yeah.
So for you, as you're, you get this short for people to show in their classrooms, are they corresponding to like, Rocco, I showed this short in my film, and I'm getting a lot of heat from the public and the school board?
That's exactly what happened. I had a gentleman named Jeremy Roden reach out to me and say, I heard this was an educational tool, and I showed it in my school, and this is happening. And he sent me a link, and I saw hundreds of PTA members talking to the school board, saying that he had done it to make the kids gay. He had done it, and it was the militant sodomite agenda, that it wasn't a film about bullying. It was, you know, in order to create a special agenda. And hearing that, and hearing the words they were calling the film and calling me, as the creator, I had to go there and show them that that was not at all what was the intention. The intention was to speak in a very unique way. And so once I was able to make my statement heard loud and clear, we had our first, the first ever talk, open talk about LGBTQ issues in that town when I went there.
Now, I would think some creators, they would put out a film, book, TV show, whatever it may be, and they release it out, and somebody may use it as an educational tool, and they might find themselves in the same situation as the teachers that were showing the short and the feature film. But now, and they would say, well, that's too bad. I'm sorry that's happened. They may tweet or something, but you decide, nope, I need to go there in person and talk to these people face-to-face. Why was that so important for you to do that?
I've seen this film change lives. On more than one occasion, I've had kids write me and tell me they showed it in their school and it stopped bullying. I had one kid send me a video testimonial telling me that she stopped cutting herself when she saw the film. I've had a 65-year-old man write me and say, you have changed my view of homosexuality. I applaud you. And that pushback and that amazing realization that this is changing things, it just supports my mission and by default makes me an activist, because I believe, and by getting that message out there and standing behind the change that it causes, both good and bad, ultimately no change happens from just waiting for something to happen. Change only comes from dialogues, when two opposing points of view can talk about their differences, and that's what this film does, is it brings it front and center and makes people talk about it.
Now, Catherine, where did you come into the process? Were you involved at the short film? Were you a fan of the short film and wanted to get involved in the feature film?
No, I just received the script from a casting office that I love that cast me in a Billy Bob Thornton movie I did called Jane Mansfield's Car, and they just always have the best independent projects. And I thought, well, this girl's got a lot of moxie to get this really terrific. They cast all of David O. Russell's movies, and they're just wonderful. They cast Silver Linings Playbook, which I think is one of the best cast movies ever. So it's Betty May casting Mary Verneau and what, Lindsey Graham. And so I thought, well, let's see what happens. And frankly, I thought, you know, message movies usually suck. Let's see what happens with this. I really did. I was like, okay, first-time director, Mary and Lindsay are casting it. It's going to be a good cast. I looked at the short. It had, you know, had many views. I thought this, I kind of just went on Rocco, you know, and Mary. And I thought, well, let's just see what happens. I knew I'd have good actors around me, and that to me matters a lot. So I did it. And then I went and saw the film. Rocco screened it for me, and I loved, on a selfish level, I loved how my own work was handled and just my own being, like the way that I look on film, just the look of the film, and just the choices, the taste involved, and also the, you know, on a bigger level, it was just the film itself. And there was just a time where Rocco needed some help at the end of the movie, and I was like, well, let me just see. Let me make that phone call for you. Let me try to do this. And the more I got involved in it, the more I couldn't stop. And I also just really believe that this film deserves a big audience, and it deserves to grow, and it's very meaningful, and it's probably one of the most meaningful things I've ever been involved with. And I believe in her, and I think that she deserves my support, and I think the movie deserves everyone's support as well. I think it's a really profound film, and I think it deserves its audience.
Now, Rocco, when you hear people, and not just Catherine, but many people associated with the film that have viewed the film, mm-hmm. and you hear these words that they say, just that how much that this speaks to them. I mean, how does that register with you? Are you flattered? Are you just overwhelmed? How do you feel about it just in terms of just the outpouring of just support and appreciation for the project?
It's shocking that you would love the face of the sodomite again so much.
Well, you know, he didn't know I was a fag pimp. High five.
High five to fag pimps.
Pimping. Hold on, let me get out my gold necklace. I kept it down, but...
Oh, that's right. She's got her bling out. Yeah. Nice. All right.
My bling's out.
Kevin's rocking the bling.
I'll be pimping. Catch me on Santa Monica Boulevard around midnight.
I am looking at a world right now that needs change. Mm-hmm. And I will not stop creating bigger ideas and using film as a medium to tell them. And I truly believe that this film can really change a piece of society out there. And I will continue to push it. And I will continue to support it until I believe it makes a change that it needs to.
Yeah, I was just want to, can I add up
Please.
To that? You know, one of the things that I read, and I always refer back to this because it's so powerful, when I was doing a little research before, doing our first red carpet, and it was that 50% of the time when one child steps up on behalf of the child that's being bullied, the bullying stops, or, you know, greatly subsides. So that's such a powerful number, you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. just like, it takes one kid. So kids see this movie, I feel like it empowers them not to be on the side of the bully. It's like the bully has all the power, the bully has all the people behind them, and then the person that's getting bullied is usually just one little person. Just one person has the courage to stand up to that bully. You know, it can completely impact that other kid's life. And it's so meaningful.
And I felt as a society we were on a good trajectory in terms of just being more open. And then the recent things with the election lining up and just realizing that there was just this kind of deep-lying just kind of feelings about just these dark kind of very biased or just, I don't want to say bigoted, but just really closed off feelings about everything. And just realizing, boy, a film like this, what you hope would not be necessary, just is still just as important, if not more important than ever.
There's so much hate out there. And I do believe that anyone that has those feelings, if they see this film, they will be changed as a result. Like, I don't feel that one of those people that is now being put into power could walk away out of this film with a dry eye. At least that's my hope. I know that's a lofty thing.
My husband and my 26-year-old straight son had never seen the movie till the LA premiere, and they both were crying. You know, and so it really gets everybody. And, you know, Rocco asked me when she was trying to develop some materials, you know, press materials, about, well, why did I want to get involved? And I, you know, and I thought about it, you know, being, you know, a mother, and I have two kids, and all of that. But then I, you know, I realized it just goes deeper, and I think it speaks to all of us, you know, and the choices that we can make and that we have made. And, you know, I was isolated for my own reasons, you know, and had my own stuff that I had to deal with as a kid, as probably a lot of us did, you know, and I think it's just very, very relatable, you know. It's also relatable in terms of not just sexuality, in terms of racism and things like that, or when just people are bullied. You know, my, the lady that works for me, it's like her grandson is being bullied because he was a preemie and he's really short. You know, there's just all these reasons why people act out of fear. I just really hope this empowers us, especially kids. I think it's geared at a young adult audience and really empowers them to make a different choice.
And how often do you get people in a dark room for you to tell them your point of view for 2 hours? That is a really special thing to have. And so we really wanted to be able to create something that would translate it. Like, we could have used any inversion, but we chose love because love speaks to everyone.
Speaking of one of that, of course, one of the stories we're going to talk about is with Jude and Ryan. And Mark, if we could play clip number two, please. As we just see their relationship kind of grow and blossom during the course of the film.
Pretty serious.
Oh my goodness. How did you do this?
I told you I could fix anything.
I like you. I like you.
Or something else.
So?
Oh, yeah. Well, my queen, your chariot awaits. Join me here, please.
You're too late.
Whoa, don't fall.
Now, Jude and Ryan's relationship really... really fun to watch, and I feel like Brianna and Tyler just make you really invest in these characters. What was it about when you're searching around casting for these roles? What was it about Brianna and Tyler that said, like, all right, these are the two actors that are perfect for these roles?
I wanted to create the most organic, true love experience. Even what you're seeing right now, I mean, this is a moment where she decides to go with her feelings and give it all up to do so. And when you see that very true love is awkward. True love is not perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't just start, you know, that kind of movie love. So this organic chemistry that they had, I could not ignore, and I just like felt so lucky to be able to work with them and create this relatable love story.
Now for this, it's so interesting because you think like this is a traditional love story, just two people falling in love, but it's in a world where this is the exception and not the norm. So in terms of them kind of coming together, when you're working out on these scenes and kind of workshopping them out, how did you work with Brianna and Tyler to kind of say like, oh yes, you're falling in love, but this isn't typical. This should feel even more awkward because this is something that this society views as you should not be doing.
You know, it's all love is similar in a way. And I think that by fostering this very beautiful, organic, almost like young connection between them was really where I wanted to go with it. Like I said before, love is not perfect. So I want to show those flaws and show those moments and really show them falling in love, and that I think was the most beautiful thing, and I think it's what keeps it relatable.
Well, it's right, as one character says, it's putting a love out in the world and getting love in return, and the only thing that's different is the plumbing. That's
right. And I think they were really able to relate to it on that level, and also, you know, I did give them a lot of my own personal experience and David's personal experience, and, you know, every character in the film is based on someone, so I was able to give them their background with the character and why they were chosen.
So, David, speaking of your experience with this, you come in as a co-writer for this feature-length film. For this, as you were saying, when Rocco comes to you and says, you know what, I don't want this to just be one story, I want to add in all these. And you were saying, yes, let's do this. As a co-writer, how did you approach this film, to take Rocco's kernel of an idea and kind of explore out into this whole feature-length film?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, she's really open to hear whatever ideas I have, but she's also someone who's very visual. So she's like, that sounds really interesting. Why don't you write that and let me take a look at it?
I like that you're passing the book back to David. That sounds interesting. Yeah, why don't you write it out?
Yeah.
You take care of that.
But that's how we work. You know, every writing team has their process. And so she and I brainstorm ideas together. And oftentimes I'm like, get out of my brain. You know, when I'm calling her. I'll call her with an idea. She's like, oh my God, get out of my head. You know, because we just saw the film. We saw the same perspective. We wanted to get the same message out there. And really the chance to explore all of these different storylines and seeing, you know, where they can go and, you know, how far can we go with like Catherine's character and how close to real life can they be to the real life situations that Rocco mentioned earlier. So we just had a chance to play, really.
It was beautiful since we were this movie was done completely independently. We were able to modify the script on the day, and actually I was able to workshop with the actors to really get organic dialogue going. So first we'd shoot the scene, and we'd run it, and I'd be like, you know what, that doesn't feel right, let's change this. What would you really say here if she said this? And so that's where some of these performances are coming from. It's from really putting them into that moment.
What I like about an approach like that is certainly what the end result ends up being such even better than what you expected, because it's such a collaboration between writer, director, and performers as well. Mm-hmm. That what the idea you envision can just be added with everybody just having their little bits of input that just makes it so much richer than what it originally was intended to be.
Most of my performance was that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was the moment where our daughter is, has just been beaten up and is in her bathroom trying to deal with that, and Rocco just wanted me to say some stuff so that it could be stuff that she would hear when she was in the bathroom, and they just rolled the camera on it and then ended up using it all. So it was like kind of completely on the fly, you know, some aspects of it.
For you as an actor, when you have moments like this where you get a chance just to really kind of play off the cuff and just kind of mm-hmm. go in the moment, how much does that excite you as a performer?
I love it. It's always so interesting because you don't know what's in there. You know, you just don't know what's in there. You know, and it's like I do a lot of homework, and I don't even know what's in there. You know, I kind of have I've been working a long time now, so I have a lot of trust in myself. So I just put in all my information and think a lot about stuff, and then, you know, I don't know what's going to come out. I didn't know that was going to come out. I didn't know I was going to do it. She didn't tell me the day before. She just said, do this, and then it all comes out. And it makes me feel great. It's really exciting. It's like just really the marriage of your subconscious with yourself and just being able to access your subconscious mind and just bring it out.
Now, your character, I mean, I have very strong opinions about mm-hmm. just in terms of sexuality mm-hmm. and the norms of the society. Mm-hmm. Now, as we want this to be really grounded, as Rocco was saying, a really grounded representation, mm-hmm. ground this in real life. And so to be able to play a person that has this viewpoint that you don't share, mm-hmm. But still want to make this seem like a three-dimensional human character. Mm-hmm. What was the process of you just kind of diving into somebody that just may just have the complete opposite point of view that you do, but still try mm-hmm. to give that person just a humanness, a humanity?
Well, you know, I think, you know, I just, you know, my own family, you know, I grew up in a very traditional home where it was kind of like, don't question authority. So I really brought a lot of that to the character. And a lot of it was just out of fear, just of anything, you know, and well-meaning. So, and Rocco told me that she wanted the character to be well-meaning, and I told her I wasn't afraid to make the character unlikable. And so we married those two. But I think, you know, I don't want anything to happen to my daughter because she's gay. And, basically in the flipped world, that's gay. You know, I don't want her to be harmed or to see harm or have harm, you know, because she's gay. I don't want anything to happen to her. And I don't want her in a world where she's exposed to gay people. You know, it's the flip, it's heterosexual, it's a little confusing to talk about it that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't want any of that around because I want her to be safe, I want her to be okay, and I'm going to be completely intolerant of anything other than that. And I think I think you guys spoke to that, that was ended up becoming a very relatable character. Yeah.
Well, it just the way, especially with...
I think because everyone has felt that way. Yeah. Like, I don't get to say anything about this. I don't get any voice here as a kid. I don't get any voice about this. I'm just going to be shut down.
And the advances in technology mm-hmm. just make it so unfortunately, so much easier to, if you want to bully somebody, to make it so much easier to do it. Mm-hmm. And when we see your daughter in the bedroom, just the constant dings on the cell phone, and then the text message that you pop up on the screen, just, why don't you kill yourself? What are you doing? You're not even worth it. You're just a breeder. Just how much... sadly easier that it is for social media, just that you can get on there and you can bully somebody and have that feeling of remove, because like, oh, I'm just saying words, not realizing the effects that it's having on another individual.
All those texts that you see in the film were actually sent to kids before they committed suicide.
Man, that is mm-hmm. that is very rough.
It's all real
down to that. And then that really brings an awareness, doesn't it?
It does.
Like, we have to stop ignoring these things, and we have to do something about it. This is our way.
Right, and that's why we try to illustrate with the different families, that you see the different family dynamics. Like, you know, Catherine's coming from the perspective, oh, I'm afraid for my daughter to be gay because what would happen to her? But in the male family, what seems to be perfect, they seem to be having family dinners and having discussions and all those things, and yet their daughter is perpetrating these crimes because she's drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak, at church, the church that they're going to. And you can see on the father's faces in the church, they're not really buying it, but they're going to church because that's what people do. That's what good people do. They go to church. And yet the daughter is just absorbing all this hate and then wanting to be the good child. Well, of course we're going to go out and kill him. We're going to beat him up because that's what God wants. You know, it's a creepy perspective.
Yeah, I personally think that there's this, and maybe it's, you know, I grew up in such a racist society, you know, growing up in the South in the early 70s, you know, and I think that it's very confusing for children to watch other people being abused, to watch other people being bullied for, you know, benign reasons, you know, because they're black, because they're gay, because of just something about who they are. I think it's very, very confusing and abusive to those children as well, you know.
The one thing I was just watching this is just, you know, in the school system, just, you, I mean, you place your children in the care of these teachers for the majority of their day. I mean, you get to be maybe during the morning before you head off to work or in the afternoon after they're back from school. But the majority of just their learning, their interaction with the society as large is happening at school. And you just see, especially with Jerry Masisto's character, just best intentions and wanting to challenge the social norms. But anytime that we see your daughter getting bullied, it's just like, where is an authority figure that can just stop this? And it always seems like just after, like, they come in just at the tail end. And they never come to see the extent of what's happening. It's just so frustrating to know that. So how much of that is happening right now? You're just like, why aren't people paying closer attention to things that are happening right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, and our society has a habit of blaming the person who was bullied. That's why Emily gets picked on by the principal.
When you see when he comes out, what are you doing? What's going on? And the first attack is towards her, even though she's getting shoved around.
Right, right. It's this weird thing that happens in our society. Like, oh, this is the one who seems to be odd. And I don't know if it's just that mentality that we have on a purely socio-physiological thing that, oh, that's the wounded one, that's the weak one, that's the one we're supposed to attack. You know, I don't know if that's a part of our mentality, because for the most part, there's a theory that we only evolved because human females are the only species on the planet that will take an injured infant and keep it and protect it and try to raise it. Whereas in like the rest of the animal kingdom, oh, there's something wrong with that one. Mm-mm. Pushing that one out of the nest. Yeah. You know, we're going to only put our energy on the ones that are going to help be healthy and strong. So thank you, ladies, for making sure that we evolved to where we are today on the internet.
the one scene that I like is with Emily and Ian when they're playing croquet, and they fall on the ground, and Emily reaches out to touch Ian's hand, and there's just that timing moment where you wonder, it makes you question for a second, is Ian recoiling just because it's like, oh, no, this is not what I'm about? Or did he really, it's like, oh, I got to get going, I really have to go? Because he also says, like, oh, yeah, I want a rematch on Saturday? That's great. So during that moment, when you're coaching that scene, what were your intentions with Ian for that?
With Ian, I really wanted to make him completely oblivious and innocent, because I think that's really a lot of the kids these days. And with Emily having such strong feelings and then Jude and Ryan having that love story, I didn't feel that it was the kids' place to have that reciprocal love story, but I did want to show innocence and how just innocent and going with what you feel can have very serious repercussions in our society. And it's time to start exploring that in a different way. There's a lot of bullying films made, but a lot of them don't get seen.
When you're talking to
then I just want to say too, you know, that I didn't really finish my thought very well, but you know, the point about that, when I'm talking about like other kids being abused, it's like, I think, you know, when there's a sense of separation, when we're told, like I was told, oh, don't watch black people on TV because, and why? Because you don't understand. You know what I mean? Stuff like that. So that's confusing. Like, well, that makes me doubt myself. I don't get it. Like, that's a funny show. You know, it's all like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So if our kids aren't the ones being bullied, but there's bullying going on around them, that's bad for them too. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it creates an unsafe world. Also for the kids that aren't being bullied. Does that make sense? It's just all so unhealthy, and you know. And I think we need to care about it, even if our kids aren't the subject matter of bullies. It's an unsafe environment. Can you imagine how traumatizing that must be to, like, that's your friend. You don't feel like you can say anything, but they're going to get beat up because they're gay, and you don't have any feeling about them. Like, you don't even get what's wrong with, who cares that they're gay, or who cares that they're black, or who cares, you know, it's like, That's so upsetting. It's so deeply, deeply disturbing and wrong for kids to have to be in those environments.
Mm-hmm. With the character of Emily is actually the story of David Tillman. And I really, our first draft, it was a boy that gets bullied, beat up because he is heterosexual. And I looked at David one day and I said, you know what? This has to be a little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl, because only then will we really see the absurdity. We couldn't obviously get David's full story in, because at a certain point it becomes unbelievable that people act this way. But David, if you want to chime in.
Yeah, there was actually stuff where she's like, well, nobody could believe that. Why is that there? I'm like, well, that's how the story happens.
If it was real, Catherine's character would have beat him up, or beat up Emily when she came home.
It's going to be so real events in your life. I considered that to the general public would be too outlandish, like too unbelievable to put in a film. I mean, how does that? I feel like you're trying to just to take a story that's yours, but then also be able to translate it in a way that audiences would still be able to take part in it and enjoy.
We actually had to do a lot of that, actually, of like toning it down so that people wouldn't just flip out too much. Not only in my storyline, but in Ryan's storyline. Some of the, you know, when Rocco was looking at different passages from Westboro, and she was saying, what do you think about that? I'm like, you can't say that. We can't get anybody to say that.
I know.
You know? She said, but that's what Fred Phelps said. You know? Yeah. So, and I think of myself as being pretty broad, you know? Yeah. Like, I don't know. So we toned it down to make it palatable.
I would think that there must be... We heard about an organization recently that's what against the misappropriation of Christ or something. Yeah. What is it? What are they called?
I don't know, but that's like really the root of the film, is that people use religion to justify hate, and that's not what God intended. And there's a lot of groups out there that support that. And I think at the end of the day, I could have any conversation with someone that's closed-minded. At the end of the day, they'll bring it back to the Bible. So we wanted to take that and put it front and center.
Yeah, I mean... I grew up in a very traditional Christian home, and summer camp and church and school. I went to, you know, all mixed together, and it just wasn't a part of my world. They didn't spend time in my church talking about who we're going to hate and separate and teach a lesson to or anything like that. It was kind of really more about the good old values of unselfishness and loving your neighbor. You know, maybe what old Jesus had in mind in the first place, but I would think that some Christians must be kind of ticked about this. It's just, it's wrong.
Yeah. One of our nonprofit partners is the Matthew Shepard Foundation, and I'm not going to give anything away. One of the characters is very much based on that of Matthew Shepard. And, you know, Matthew Shepard's killers were not sad after his death. They are on record saying that they felt justified to do that, and it really goes back to that very element that we were just discussing. And I think
that's very confusing too for people, because I think there's probably a lot of well-meaning people in some very, very conservative churches that don't know where to put their foot about this. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like they probably in their heart of hearts don't want anybody to get beat up or shot in a nightclub because of their sexuality, but where do they stand when their church is so against it, you know?
David, for you, sharing your story as Emily's, but even dialing back, was it still, was there a sense of catharsis being able to put that out there for you?
Absolutely. Certainly in the short film, because we did it first. But I think in the end, because we changed the sex and it became a little girl, it was actually easier for me to watch it as opposed to so engaging. And I mean, in the writing process, I was very engaged. Yeah. But being able to take the one step back, the perspective, because I've been very fortunate both times working with Rocco on these projects, but I get to sit next to her and watch the process, which for those of you who don't know, the writer doesn't often get to be there. But because of our collaborative spirit, you know, basically she knows if I'm going to say anything to her at all, it really means something to me. Because I hold my tongue. You know, she's director, she's the director. You know, she's making the final decision on things. So I know that in the writing process, anything that I feel strongly about, we'll discuss. It'll be on the page. And then she'll say, you know, it's not going to follow the vision. I'm like, okay, then we'll go along with that, because she has the vision for a film that I'm not seeing the whole vision. I'm not in her head as much as I think I am. But all that being said, it's an amazing collaborative process to sit there with the director, to watch it unfold. And then when we're in the editing process, she's like, didn't we have a take where, like, yes, we did. You know, because I'm not, you know, I get to just watch mm-hmm. as opposed to being in the moment of I have to be this and I have to answer that and this is going to be blue and that's going to be green and that, you know, all that. I just get to watch the whole process to be able to say, oh yeah, no, there was that. You're right. You're not crazy.
One of the most amazing moments was to look over at you when the magic was happening. These scenes were taking a life of their own, like the merry-go-round scene. Mm-hmm. That was intense, and just to look at David, and we're just like crying, you know, because it's so powerful, and you feel it in that moment, and you feel this change that you know will happen when people see it. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Now I know you're talking about like dialing back some of what many people would consider unrealistic elements. Was that done during the writing process, or was it when you're in the editing and you're realizing, let's cut these little bits out of the scene so we can kind of dial back some of those real
unrealistic? Both. Yeah, well, there's a lot more sermon shot than made it. At a certain point, it's like a lot, and I don't mm-hmm. want the audience to shut down. So we actually...
And you're not making an anti-Christian movie.
No.
At all.
No. Actually, we have a reverend that supports our film. She just traveled with us all around the country supporting our mission and talking
reverend,
about...
Reverend Betty Diaz-Clark.
Yeah. She's the former pastor of the AME church that was the unfortunate victim of a hate crime about a year ago.
In Charleston.
Yeah, that's all the news.
Yeah.
And she's seen firsthand, you know, religion be misinterpreted, and she sees this film as a way to speak out about that and kind of check it. And so it's an amazing thing to have her kind of backing us up in this regard. So, like, you know, that is probably one of the more controversial things that happens in the film. Mm-hmm. And so we do get a lot of questions. And when she's with us, I could just be like, why don't you take this one? Right. It could just take this one.
But what's interesting, though, about the film is that at the end of the day, in my opinion, it is a faith-based film because Jude and Emily never lose their faith in God, no matter what happens to them. You know, they mm-hmm. maintain a strong faith. In fact, the whole turning point for Jude near the end is her faith. You know, it never gets tarnished, no matter what.
That's true, because even there's times when she decides that she wants to follow a relationship with Ryan, you still see her in church, and even though Reverend Rachel not giving her the best advice at all, but she's not somebody, like you're saying, that is turning away from everything, like, oh, I renounce everything about this. No, she still has her faith.
She's still praying to God. Even at the end, she cites the Bible quote, you know, and she never loses that, and that's so important as a protagonist and ultimately for the overall vision of the film, because if you're different, you don't have to lose your faith in God.
Right, and that actually happened for me, and I was in North Carolina and had fallen in love with a man, and was always very Catholic and involved in the church, heavy duty, and sitting out there looking at the ocean thinking, love is not wrong, this is wrong, this doctrine is wrong, love is not wrong. And it was almost one of the last times I was in a Catholic church. But I still have maintained my faith in God and religion faith and spirituality.
Mm-hmm. And that love that you're talking about, you see it in Jude and Ryan, you see it so innocent and just like, you see it just bleeding from them, and you just know that, you know, kind of taking that and flipping it, like, it's the same.
Now, as we're wrapping up here, certainly you were all excited. You cite the carousel scene, for example, where you see that you're seeing that this is happening. You're making this, you're like, this is what you want to achieve with this film is happening. Now, you've released it in film festivals and getting many accolades in there. So how does it feel to you share that moment on the carousel? You're filming that scene like, oh, yes, this is happening. And then you share it with a greater, wider audience, and you realize, yes, they're receiving the message that we're trying to convey.
Let's talk about that. So we have a little bit of a different distribution strategy for this film. When Orlando hit, we were festivaling, and I was just struck by what had happened. And it was then where we decided to pull the film, which was set to be distributed in 2017, and release it during election time ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so we traveled to 20 cities in 30 days and had public screenings with a reverend and talked about the film all across the nation and engaged nonprofits, 20 of them actually, to support it when it came out. And then we released it ourselves on Thanksgiving in order to create change in a world that needs it.
But also, these grassroots organizations, they need money for what they're going to do. So we've created a fund that once the film reaches 1 million downloads on iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play, get all three out there, we'll create a $1 million fund that will go then back out to these nonprofits to help them do the work that they're doing. So it's not just, oh, great, help us.
We're creating this change with the movie, and it will play in perpetuity to them, and we will keep creating initiatives kind of in this space where we...
5% in perpetuity of the film's profits go to... these 20 nonprofits.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I wish we could talk about this, but we're running out of time. But if audiences want to continue to follow Love Is All You Need, of course they can get it on Amazon, iTunes, or Google Play. But if they want to keep following what you're doing with the film, where's the best place to keep track?
LoveIsAllYouNeedTheMovie.com. Also our Instagram accounts, if they're up there.
Mine's Facebook.
Facebook. I mean, we're very social media savvy. So
I've learned so much about social media.
Speak for yourself.
Quick, Kathy, I saw you out there. You're getting ready for the tweet to do this before this. Yeah.
This film is my life, so if you follow kind of what we're doing, you'll see a lot of change happening.
I mean, as you're saying, that now that it's out there, the work is still continuing, but to have this out there, is there a sense of relief, or it's like, nope, I got to get back into it. The work doesn't stop.
The work
does not stop.
Does not stop. Yeah. It's just the beginning.
Yeah, every time we get to a juncture, we think, okay, well, great. Oh, there's more. And we have other announcements coming in the next.
Coming soon.
Yeah.
You're going to be seeing a lot of us.
Yes, you are.
Speaking of that, if they want to follow of course, Love Is All You Need, that come to follow the film. But if they want to follow you individually to kind of keep up on any sort of updates you may be having on Love Is All You Need or other future projects, David, if we'll start with you. Where's the best place?
Tillmanism at Instagram, but it's like Tillmanism everywhere. AOL. Gmail.
Very cool. Catherine?
I'm Lady LaNasa, LANASA.
Oh, very nice.
Instagram,
very regal.
And Facebook. It's a nickname. What can I say?
And Rocco?
Rocco Shields across the board. Rocco Shields, Google it, you'll find it.
All right, look at that. Folks, that's going to do it right now for this edition of iTalk Movies, though. But please, go check out Love Is All You Need. You can find it on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play. Find it anywhere else. They're going to be doing, are you going to be going out showing it anywhere else? Or is it just basically, on downloads is right where it's
at? Stay tuned.
Big announcements coming. So follow them on social media. Check out LoveIsAllYouNeed.com to find out more about the film and what you have an opportunity to not only see maybe at home, but elsewhere out in the general public as well. Thank you so much for all coming in today. It was so great
to talk to you.
Oh, you don't have to say that right now. That's fine, guys. you can follow me on Twitter at Happy Go Jackie. Until next time, we'll be back with another edition of iTalk Movies soon. We'll see you then.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.